You're listening to the Bird Dog Babe Podcast with my mom, Courtney Bastian.
This episode is presented to you by Purina Pro Plan and Boss Shot Shells.
I think you have a lot of breeders that look for or manipulate that golden picture, and then they don't share the reality. And that's where we wind up getting into trouble. And suddenly you have dogs that are producing, or your point of filters, right? Like, people think they're breeding to this dog with spectacular pigment, and all of a sudden they're getting puppies that are completely lacking. Like, well, how does that happen? Well, because this photo or every photo has the same filter applied. So you don't know that this dog is lacking in pigment unless you were to see him in person.
It's crazy to think that there are only 4 days left of this season. Where in the heck did time go? I have one last trip planned to Idaho and Oregon in January before I hang up my hunting vest, but I'm already making plans for trips and challenges in 2022. We had such a nice Christmas with family visiting here from Wisconsin. It was fun to share some of our harvest from this season with them for our Christmas dinner. Although the gift for my husband was a complete fail, I had got him a flight and hotel to the NAVDA annual meeting in California, which was to be held in only 3 weeks, and I received an email 2 days before Christmas that it was canceled. I'm hoping Delta will allow me to change it and send him to Omaha for Pheasant Fest in March instead, but the wait time to get through to Delta has been 2.5 hours, and I don't have the patience for that. Or else, I suppose he'll be headed to California for some sightseeing in LA. Oh my god, he'd hate that. Did you know that Purina Pro Plan has an entire line of veterinary formulas? If your vet suggests your dog needs to be put on a veterinary diet and doesn't carry the Pro Plan line, you can upload the prescription to ProPlanVetDirect.com and have it delivered directly to your door. If your dog has allergies, is overweight, has urinary issues, needs some joint support or neurological support, ProPlan has a veterinary diet for it. I actually add a small handful of dental health from the veterinary line to my dog's meals as a preventative for tartar. Go to Purina.com to find out more. Boss Shot Shells has 12 gauge shells on the production line this week. So be sure to go to their website, BossShotShells.com, every morning as they update their stock. Lee Chose of Boss messaged me a couple days ago that they have big things coming this year that I will love. And he actually put love in all capital letters. I can't wait to find out what they are up to. Siren Shotguns, the only full line of shotguns for women. A great perk if you buy a Cesar Guarini shotgun is their pit stop program. When you invest in a high-quality Cesar Guarini shotgun, you get their unprecedented service that protects your investment and assures maximum performance from your firearm. Once a year, you can ship your shotgun to them for a free service and tune-up with a turnaround time of approximately 15 days. I took advantage of that program last year, and I will be doing it again this February. I just got off the phone with the folks at Siren, and there will be a new field gun added to the lineup this year. And as excited as I am to share it, I can't. But if you're attending the SHOT Show in Vegas in a few weeks, you'll get to see the big reveal. Find a Siren dealer or demo center near you at SirenUSA.com. I shared a Facebook post yesterday about a dog being lost after a car wreck outside of Missoula. And a couple weeks ago, one of our dog training clients was in a rollover accident and the dog was injured. I'm guilty too of sometimes allowing my dogs to ride outside of their crates when I make short trips. But it's situations like these that remind me it's just not worth it, especially this time of the year on winter roads. Our dogs are most safe riding in their crates, so if you don't have one, make that immediate investment to protect your dog, and even yourself, because a dog in pain will bite you. Go to Dakota283.com and use promo code BIRDDOGBABE for 10% off. Members of my Patreon page received the live video recording of this episode yesterday. I'll be posting the video this week of the bird plucking webinar that Emily Spoiler and Katie Willis put on a few weeks where they demonstrated a couple different techniques. If you'd like to support the production of this podcast, watch the video recordings of each episode, get additional content and learning opportunities, additional discounts, and the awesome giveaways, go to patreon.com/thebirddogbabe to join for $5 per month. My guest today is Kelly Scher. Kelly is a second-generation breeder of merit and bird dog enthusiast. She provides insight on how social media can sway our decision-making to buy and sell a puppy, choosing a stud dog, breeder, or a dog trainer, and shares tips and recommendations to help make decisions beyond what's on the gram. All right, let's get after it.
Hey, Kelly, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Courtney.
How's it going?
It's going. I miss having you guys local to us.
I know. This is like our first season that we haven't hunted together. It's a very sad thing.
Because last year we were able to hook up at least in midway, halfway through the country.
I know. You are the first woman I ever hunted with. Do you know that?
I didn't know that. I think that would probably be mutual. I don't think I've hunted with any women. I'm like rolling through my brain trying to figure out if there was another one before you, but I don't think there was.
Special firsties. First time experience.
Hunting over your dogs are the first dogs that I ever hunted with. So.
Oh, cool. Well, that's fun. And then you ended up getting wire hair. So I feel like you must have had a good experience.
Yeah, totally. And I was able to talk the boyfriend into one of your wire hairs too after Bill was kind enough to take him out. So.
Oh, that's right. At the National.
While we were busy showing dogs and doing the pretty dog thing, they were out with Carmen and Bisto, which... If there was ever a pair that you're going to be hunting over for the first, that was his first pointing dog experience.
Really? Yeah. That'll get you hooked with those two. That's for sure.
That's the pair to do it with.
That's the A team.
Yeah, totally.
He wasn't screwing around.
No. And Matt still talks about that trip. So.
Aw, super fun.
Yeah.
So where are you coming to us from tonight?
I am just outside of Chicago. So I'm about 45 minutes to an hour northwest of Chicago in Illinois, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Hopefully moving soon.
Yes. Sooner than later?
Hopefully in the next year to two. Perfect. At the most.
Perfect. Because mom is out there now.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah, mom's out there. Mom is western side. She's closer to you guys. Matt's got family on the eastern side. So.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Well, we're talking about mom right now. So just if listeners want to try to connect the dots here, mom is Brenda Belmonte, who was on like one of my very first episodes.
Right. I totally forgot that you had her on back in the early days.
Yes. Yeah. And she talked about the time when we had like a lot of the COVID puppies and stuff. Mm-hmm. So it was a really cool and interesting episode. Yeah. So getting on that, you are second generation dog gal.
Yes, I got very spoiled that I did not have to break into the dog world. Mm-hmm. I was born into it, and I was very lucky to have a mom who inspired all things dog. So I was in dog show rings in the womb and going to dog shows before I could walk and talk, and grew up doing juniors and confirmation, and have been whelping litters and helping raise puppies since I could walk and talk. So I lucked out that I didn't have to kind of fight my way in like some folks have to as adults or young adults. I lucked out there. Grew up with pugs, was our original breed, although my mom also had some herding dogs, some Belgians and some German Shepherds growing up. We had kind of an eclectic collection with Borzoi and Whippets in the mix too. So I've been kind of all over the map.
Yeah. And now you're deep and heavy into the bird dogs.
I am. Now I'm down to just one singular pug who, thanks to your husband throwing a chucker for him at a training day, thinks he's also a bird dog.
He is a bird dog.
but we've got a wire-haired pointer in the house. I breed and own tollers as well, Nova Scotia duck tolling retrievers. So my beloved also had a Labrador when I met him. So we've had kind of the collection. I also co-own some curly-coated retrievers. I was blessed to have you introduce me to the wonderful world of Broccos, or Brocky, I guess.
Brocky, Brocky, I don't know.
If I'm going to pronounce it wrong, somebody's going to be mad. But
yeah.
So I co-owned Bracken with you, and I co-owned Quigley with Steve and Robin out in South Dakota. So we have kind of an eclectic mix of bird dogs in our life.
You also hunt over all those dogs that you co-own.
Yeah.
Is like the super cool part of it.
I feel really lucky because there's a lot of people that get their start in confirmation or get their start in handling that experience breeds through all of the dog show side of things that don't get to see the functional side. And I feel like I'm really lucky to have such incredible friends that have become essentially family, where I get to see the functional side. I get to hunt over them. You know, we do tower shoots, we do upland, we do waterfowl, and I get to see and experience kind of all those different facets of the different breeds, which is really, really neat.
Mm-hmm. And tomorrow morning you're going goose hunting.
We are. It'll actually be our COVID puppy's first goose hunt. So we'll see how that goes.
He's still exciting. How old is Munchie now?
He's almost two. He'll be two in April.
Wow.
So we've had him out pheasant hunting a couple times. Public land is hard to get into birds around here. So he unfortunately hasn't had a ton of bird contact. But he's squirrel hunted and been great with that. So we'll see if that can transfer to geese tomorrow.
Yeah. Yum. I'm going to have to hear your squirrel recipe too at some point.
That's all Matt. He's the chef in our house.
Do you like it?
It was really good. I have a hard time getting past the, like, it was a squirrel.
Yeah.
So I have to get past like the mental piece of it. But it was really delicious.
How did you have it? Was it like in a soup or was it straight up squirrel on de plate?
It was straight up squirrel on de plate. He grilled it like as like a little squirrel kebab. So I think also seeing it come off the kebab as like a squirrel probably didn't help with the mental piece. But he was kind enough to like pick some pieces off the bone for me so that I didn't have to like gnaw on a little squirrel leg.
Sure.
But it was good. Our usual go-to when we start new game, cause that was my first squirrel experience, was the one that Munchie had brought back. We start all of our game pan fried in butter usually just to get like a base flavor. And then we go from there. So the grill was a little bit of a departure from that, but it was good.
I'm reverting back to our chipmunk episode, like experience. And all I can think of is you eating a squirrel and knowing what your reaction was to not grabbing that chipmunk from Potter.
So she now swallowed pelican style the chipmunk and at least one, if not multiple, field mice, because I just, nope, that's all you, Pots, whatever you...
Did she swallow it that day?
Yeah, she swallowed it like a pelican.
Full on.
Like we had her jaw open and it just down the gullet it went.
And whole. I remember being worried about like, is it going to do damage through her esophagus as it goes down? Because it's alive and it's a rodent and it bites.
Yeah.
She was just like, that was great. Let's go look for another one.
No worse for the wear. She would do it again without thinking twice. And probably has when I'm not looking.
Oh, she's a fun one.
She's awesome. And we're so thankful for her.
Oh my gosh. Let's go into how you got started. Like, did you get into hunting first or shooting?
I got more into the shooting thing first. So when I met Matt, he is an avid shooter. He's been an avid hunter. He really introduced me to the shotgun side of things. I had a little bit of experience with handguns, but not a lot on the shotgun side of things. So he introduced me to the shotguns, kind of similar to your story with getting into hunting with like the dog looked at you like, dude, what are you doing? We had this moment of like, you have bird dogs, you have Pistol, who at the time was like a year and a half, 2 years old. Like, why aren't you hunting her? She would be great. She would love it. I don't like the pug owner in me can't let her off leash. Like she's going to run away. So I started with the shotguns and sporting clays and that kind of stuff before we got into hunting. My first hunt, I stepped into a boot sucking mud bog up to my crotch in the first 15 minutes we were in the field. So it was not a great first experience. But luckily Matt was fabulous and he actually took off his socks and gave me his dry socks and went barefoot in his boots for the rest of his Veterans Day hunt that was supposed to be in honor of him. Just to make sure that I had a positive first experience.
And that's when you knew he was the one.
Totally. And here we are on, I don't know, 4 or 5 seasons later.
Right.
So, you know.
That's adorable. Yeah, no one needs to start out their hunt with a wet crotch.
It was not okay. It was not good. Not good. Mm-mm.
So then after the shooting and the veterans hunt, then you started doing more of the other upland mm-hmm. hunting?
Yeah, we actually, I had a good friend of ours who also had tollers who did a lot of goose hunting that was like, why don't you guys come out? Matt really hadn't done a lot of waterfowl hunting. Why didn't you come out? Why didn't you come learn? I will be honest, the first half of the day, it was like, oh my God, why do people do this? Like, this is so boring. I can't imagine why people would sit here. Of course, we were totally unprepared. Like, we weren't dressed right for the weather. Like, we knew nothing about anything. And the last half hour or so of shooting light, we really had a flurry of birds and you got the adrenaline going. And it was like, oh my gosh, okay, this is why people sit out here in the cold and do this. So we actually started doing more water, or I started doing more waterfowl hunting. Matt had upland hunted for a long time prior to meeting me. And then from there, I think we had gotten into more of the upland. You and Bill were wonderful to take us out with your crew, Carmen and Stasha and Merritt, shortly after Potter became ours. And that was kind of our foray into some of the Wisconsin public land hunting.
The apple pie day.
Yes. Apple pie for dinner, apple pie moonshine to top it off. It was like the perfect capture that day. Of course, that was like the day that Matt shot everything. All of the birds we saw, Matt shot
he did.
All of them.
Yep, he did.
Very selfish.
Yep.
So now we make a trip out to South Dakota for a week every year to make sure that we get the dogs on wild birds. We buy a Wisconsin license every year, even though we're in Illinois, just because there's a little bit better access up across the border than where we're at right now. But that was kind of the foray into the bird dog world of actual hunting for me.
So your first bird dog was a wire hair, right?
Correct.
And then you got the toller.
Sort of, yeah.
Okay.
My ex-husband had decided he wanted a bird dog, and we actually borrowed a toller. So Pistol's mom, because again, being lucky that I was already in the dog world, I had friends. So we actually borrowed a toller from a friend of ours to see, like, does this fit our lifestyle? Is this what we really want? Ex-husband wasn't convinced. We wound up getting the wire hair. So Skull from you guys was the first bird dog that was actually mine in our house. But that toller kind of came and went throughout the years. And she came for shows. And while she was here for shows, they were like, well, you might as well do some field work with her, get your feet wet. She's totally trained. She can show you what to do. Put a working certificate on her. Turns out she wasn't totally trained. They just told me that so I wouldn't be nervous. great. Probably a smart move on their part. But so I really got hooked on the tollers at that point. But the wire hair was the first full-time bird dog in our house. And then shortly after he came into our lives, Pistol's litter was born, and I had co-bred, I co-owned Avery, so I co-bred and name the litter, and I was like, I want a puppy, and my co-breeder in Kentucky was like, oh, they've all got homes, the one that you've fallen in love with is going up north to this really great home, and we're really excited about it, and she's got this great home lined up, and I was like, oh, okay, I'm glad she's got a good home. It turned out the home was mine, I just didn't know it. So that was the first full-time toller in the house, and for the most part, I've had a toller and a wire hair in the house consistently since then, so...
Talk to me a little bit about tollers, because my only experience is what I know when I'm with you. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I did go to a training event. I can't think of the woman's name, but it was like in Fond du Lac, and she was showing me how they test and the tollers go mm-hmm. back and forth. So explain that a little bit, because that is like the key characteristic of the breed, right?
Yes. So tollers are kind of an interesting retriever. They are a retrieving breed, but they were believed to be created through a mix of setter-like dogs, retriever-like dogs, not any necessarily set breed, and even with some influence from farm collie. So they have a little bit of like a herding dog feel to them. But the tulling is essentially they were bred to mimic a fox. So the way the fox plays back and forth along the bank with their tail up in the air, and that motion of the tail kind of dancing above them as they run back and forth while the hunter is behind a blind or behind a tree, whatever, brings ducks closer. So you would think that ducks would see like a predatory like animal and would go the other way. They're apparently not really bright. They don't. They swim closer to take a closer look. And so the goal was to throw a stick or a ball or a bumper or whatever and have the dog kind of play along the shore, bring the ducks in closer so that the hunter could then flush when they were in closer range, throw a stick, a stone, whatever, send the dog to get the birds to flush, shoot them in closer range, and then the dog would go out and retrieve.
Yeah, so this totally puts me into confusion of all, like, let's hunt in a blind and put the dogs in a blind and wear camo so they can't be seen. Mm-hmm. So this is like mind blown right now.
It's like the antithesis of what we think of as far as hunting goes. But I've not told with mine personally. We just don't have the hunting setup for it. But I've seen videos of dogs doing it, you know, in a real life hunting situation. And they do. The ducks swim right up to the shore like, oh, what's going on over there? That looks interesting.
Crazy.
It's a really unique way to hunt. The other tulling breed is the Quaker, and I'm not going to try to pronounce the whole breed because I'll butcher it and make people angry. But they lured the ducks into nets. So the Quakers would kind of do the same thing, get the ducks' interest, swim away from them toward nets that got like progressively smaller, is my understanding. Mm-hmm. And then the dogs would swim out under the nets and they would capture the ducks in them. So Basically, the two different types of tolling.
Super cool. I'm really intrigued by that. I'm definitely going to go spend some time on YouTube just to watch some more of that because that's super cool. And we have like a really interesting topic to talk about today, but I still would just want to dig into this toller thing a little bit more because I don't talk about it a lot.
Yeah.
But since you are so in tune, you know, to a lot of different aspects of bird dogs in general, you have appreciation for several different breeds and personal interest with them. And, you know, as you know, like the health testing is really important to me, the temperament and the structure, you know, and the ability. So all the things. And if you don't mind, can you share like for people that might be interested in getting a Nova Scotia duck tolling retriever puppy? I mean, like that is such a mouthful.
Let's just go with toller.
When they're looking for a breeder, what health tests would you recommend that the breeder has done on the sire and the dam of the litter?
So the recommended tests from the club are hips, elbows, PRA, which is progressive retinal atrophy, hips, elbows, PRA, and then having the OFA eye exams done. I personally would not even consider a puppy from somebody who's not also testing for juvenile Addison's. It's a Addisonian disease unique to the tollers and it presents really young. Life altering, can be expensive to treat. So for me, that's a non-negotiable. Toller people have a lot of health testing at their disposal. Last I checked, I think we were at 15 or 16 total tests, including two different ones for cleft palates. We have a dilute, test. So that's coat color versus, something health related. So you'll find a very wide range of opinions about what's important and what isn't. For me, the PRA and the juvenile Addison's, the hips and the elbows are probably the most important.
Okay.
You know, you want to make sure that you have a dog that's sound orthopedically that can keep up with the hunting. Again, the Addison's and the PRA causing the blindness, some things that really impact quality of life. One that's a little bit more controversial is our chondrodystrophy test. So we are a dwarf breed. And there is a link between carrying the dwarf genes and an increased risk of intervertebral disc disease. So that's a little bit more of a newer test. It's a little bit of a controversial test. Some people have the view that you know, we're a high octane sporting breed that doesn't always have a lot of self-preservation. We're kind of prone to the inevitable disc disease anyway. You know, is it a genetic thing? Is it an environmental? Is it injury related? Is it, you know, are they predisposed because of the genetic link? So talking to different breeders is going to get people different opinions on that.
Sure.
So, you know, do your research, do your due diligence, form your opinion, and then find a breeder that kind of matches what your opinion is on that piece. But for me, like I said, the juvenile Addisons especially is a non-negotiable for me.
With the dwarfism thing, I mean, like your breed is super awesome, compact little package, you know, what fun little easy to get around with dogs. And I mean, is the dwarfism going to be noticeable for somebody that is going to go buy a puppy at 8 weeks old?
So a truly dwarf toler, yes. They almost look like a dachshund. Like they'll present with the super, super short legs, very disproportionate. Most of the way that it presents in the breed, you're not going to be able to tell from phenotype. So for instance, Munchie, my young dog, if I were to look at him, I would have suspected that he would be a carrier of at least one copy, just because he's a little bit lower on leg, a little bit longer in body, which is correct for the breed. But again, that's where the dwarf influence comes in.
Sure.
He has come back genetically from two different, because I didn't believe the first test. he's come back from two different labs as being what we consider a wild type, which is the, normal. So, typically your wild type dogs, your normal will be a little bit longer leg, a little bit longer proportioned, maybe a little bit more square bodied. Your YY dogs, so your dogs that carry two copies, tend to have a little bit of shortening of the bone. They tend to be a little bit lower and longer. Genetics are a wild thing. You can't always tell from looking at them, that dwarf influence, unless you do get a truly, chondrodysplastic dog that's really on that shorter side, like a dachshund would be.
Okay. What about temperament? What is their temperament like overall in the breed?
So they should be a confident retriever. Everything tends to be kind of on their own terms. So whereas you have like the Goldens and the Labs that most people think of as a retriever temperament, they're not going to be as much of a people pleaser, the tollers. They're not going to be as social. So I always tell people that they're kind of dismissive of people outside of their circle. Pistol's the perfect example. She'll go up to somebody that she thinks has treats or has something to give her. And the minute she realizes that there's no cookies involved, it's kind of like, okay, thanks. Bye. They just don't have this, for the most part. You'll find unicorns, but for the most part, they don't have this innate desire to like socialize and be with people. And,
sure.
You know, whereas Potter,
which a lot of people like,
right.
You know, like a dog that's like, you know, I think of Labs and Goldens being all up in your face. They want to lick you all the time and I need to be touching you. You know, some people just like a nice bird dog that isn't so damn needy.
Yes.
Right.
And that's the tollers like to be in the same room as their people. They might hop on the couch and cuddle for a little bit and then they kind of go off and do their own thing. Like they kind of want to be on the other side of the same room. Whereas, you know, Potter, the wire hair, if she could unzip your skin and become one with you, she would, like very, very different temperaments there. So if somebody is getting a toller expecting them to be a small golden or a small lab, they're going to be sorely disappointed at best and probably very ill-prepared at worst. The tollers are wickedly smart. They're not as forgiving of handler mistakes or of a heavy hand, as a lab or a golden might be. They very much, I consider them sensitive, but not soft. So they can take a fair correction as long as they understand what's being asked. But if you're, you know, unfair or you're correcting things that you haven't taught, they don't understand the expectation, they're going to say, forget you and go the other way.
Sure. So let's get into our topic for today about the influence that social media has on our dog breeding decisions, our dog buying decisions, and what's real and what's fake on what we're seeing on and what social media is doing to the dog industry, bird dog industry, all dog industry, really.
All dogs really across the board.
Right.
I think, you know, as we head into this conversation, the idea of social media is like the highlight reel, right? Like we hear that about people all the time of, you know, make sure you approach it as like knowing that people are showing you what they want you to see. I think that's something very important to take into this conversation as we talk about kind of the influence or the things that are out there.
Oh, for sure. Great point, Kelly. So photos. So how photos can make or break a dog.
Yeah.
Or a breeder.
Yeah. I, you know, with the digital age, it's so easy to manipulate what we wouldn't have seen in the past. You know, a 35 millimeter photo, there's only so much you can do with it. I think I've seen a lot of questionable editing, especially in the Facebook days. One of my favorites is to see people edit out check cords in their photos, which I always makes me shake my head because, you know, anybody that's done any kind of training with a bird dog or any dog for that matter, you know, a check cord is a tool. It's a foundational thing. Like there's no shame in using it. But that's one of the things that I see probably most frequently where I'm like, why is this the thing that we're ashamed of? Why is this the thing that we feel like we need to hide from the world?
Right. Right. Because it just doesn't give that clear, pretty picture of a dog that may or may not be able to point on its own without having the pressure of that cord. I don't know, but you're exactly right. A lot of people use it as a training tool to study up their dogs and leave it in there. No big deal.
Yeah. I see it in retrievers too, of people that I just, you know, I'm not ashamed to admit my young dog doesn't have as reliable of a recall as I would like. But again, you know, it's a tool. So it's again, that idea of like the reality, are you seeing reality or are you seeing what somebody wants you to see?
And I think too, with filters and how they can kind of make or break a dog. And, you know, I think as a breeder, like, let's just say with German wire hair pointers, you know, it's ideal. You want your dogs to have a dark eye. Mm-hmm. And as both someone that's looking at potential stud dogs out there, or even dogs that I've bred, like if I've bred a dog and then one of my owners really likes to use filters and all of a sudden lights it up and the eyes look bright yellow.
Yeah. Coming at it from a breeder mindset or even just a person who engages in confirmation, I imagine that there's some facets of the field world that would be this way too, though I can't think of any examples off the top of my head. But I had a conversation not too long ago with a friend of mine who took some really fabulous photos of his dog. And he's like, I love the way he looks and I love the background and I love the lighting and the sunset, but I can't share it because his front's a little easty-westy and I'm afraid people are going to rip him apart.
Mm-hmm.
And that aspect of it really kind of made me sad because it, from a photography standpoint, the picture that he took of this dog was absolutely beautiful. And you could see the love of his dog in it. And you could see, you know, just the love of being outdoors and celebrating that like human canine connection. But we do have this bit with social media now where it's really easy for people to take that one moment in time and just pull it apart and use it as a way to criticize somebody or criticize a breeding program or criticize a stud dog. And that sometimes makes me sad. And I'm sure I've been guilty of it as most of us have. That was definitely a moment in my life where I kind of stopped like, man, that's really unfortunate that you feel like you have to keep it to text messages because you can't put it where people can see it.
But it's the thing too of, I think now more people and breeders especially have taken to almost becoming marketers, and that taking precedence over just being good breeders.
Right. We almost have to be. I mean, in the world of instant gratification and the world of, you know, doodle breeders or mixed breed breeders, having, you know, everything readily available and a beautiful website and a beautiful Facebook page, and you can click buy it now and, you know, you have a puppy at your door 24 hours later. Breeders have been kind of, good breeders have been kind of forced to step up their game. And I think social media in some ways makes it easier. It's a lot easier for me to upload a picture to a Facebook page than it is to log in and update a website. So, you know, there's some positives in that realm. But in these days of like people looking for, we're a digital world. So people looking for flashy graphics and beautiful pictures and, you know, the days of influencers and all of that. If you don't have those images or those things to catch people's attention, you just get lost.
Totally. Absolutely. And I can just say, you know, from having some sponsors and partners and stuff in this, doing this podcasting stuff, they're like, oh yeah, if you could send us some photos. I'm like, oh my God, you don't want to see my photos. I'm not going to do you justice. Yeah. But hopefully the fact that like I have a lot of integrity and I'm not going to tell people that I use, you know, so-and-so brand of an e-collar and then I don't, but you know, I'm getting paid to do it. You know what I mean? Or just change it because a new sponsor will come along and say, like, hopefully, I just hope that, you know, why can't we just do real, genuine things anymore?
Yeah.
And it all has to be about what's good for the gram.
Yeah. I think that's one of the biggest downsides. And I know you and I talked about this a little bit off air, but just this idea that like social media makes it really easy for people to kind of nitpick. And it also makes people really creative in how they advertise because people have gotten so, I don't know if it's, people have gotten so used to looking at things black and white, right? And so if you don't do X, Y, and Z, and you don't have a beautiful website and you don't have these catchy pictures and people can't see your dog, you know, pointing and doing confirmation and do, if all of that isn't readily available for the public to have at their fingertips, right? People get labeled as like, well, you're not a good breeder. You're a backyard breeder. You're an irresponsible breeder. The flip side to that being that oftentimes some of those people that have all of those things have, just to your point, gotten really good at marketing. I often tell people that are asking me questions about finding breeders and certain breeds that there's a lot of people out there that are very creative advertisers. So having, you know, a dog with a junior title means that they're producing dogs for field. Having a dog with, you know, the classic irresponsible breeder, you know, it's champion bloodlines, right? There's no accomplishments of that particular person, but they've learned these buzzwords or they've learned these terms or these, they've learned how to do the pictures to pull people that are thinking they're doing their research to pull those people in and kind of fool them into thinking they're getting something they're not.
True. And I think with so much of it, that's the importance of just going and seeing it in person. In our breeding program, you know, I think it was our very first litter in 2007. Our first stud dog was the dog that we used frozen semen on, so we never met him. But since that day, since that very first dog, we have either hunted over, personally trained, or gone to a national and been able to watch that dog run in a field trial before making a decision of whether or not to breed to it. Because so much can be influenced by what you see or don't see. I mean, I know a lot of fantastic breeders that aren't even on social media.
Yeah. So especially a lot of your I don't want to be ageist here, but a lot of your old time breeders, your people that have been in it forever, that have done everything and seen everything as much as one can, a lot of those people aren't active on social media. They don't have active websites, or if they have an active website, it's not really pretty or professionally done. And I think people need to learn how to look past that to, you know, do exactly what you guys have done and see the value of the dogs and the work that the dogs are doing and have their hands on them. And these days of COVID, that's really hard. I know a lot of breeders like aren't welcoming people into their homes anymore. So that's something that kind of needs to be navigated. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as we return to some semblance of normalcy, being able to go to different events, go to shows, go to trials, go to hunt tests, you know, maybe it's not going to your breeder's home, but doing exactly what you guys have done and just seeing them out and active in some way, and getting to see them outside of the computer or the phone.
Going back to that point of, if there's not a picture of it happening, then it didn't happen type of thing. Like, let's just say if a dog's a show champion, right? Like the hunting dog people are like, oh, that's from show lines all the time. Like this is a no-win thing. Yep. And then you have the hunting dogs that, you know, where it's like, oh, well, they probably have terrible structure and they're going to break down when they're 8 years old because they can't hold up. And so it goes back and forth. Mm-hmm. But, you know, just because a dog has a show title doesn't mean it can't hunt. Or just because it doesn't have hunting, or wait, let's go that backwards. The other way around. Yes, just because it's a hunting dog and doesn't have a show title doesn't mean it couldn't gain one.
Right, right. Well, so, and I think it goes into, you know, really looking at a dog for what it is. I'm optimistic that we're seeing a little bit of a shift in mentality, especially with this, you know, break from events that COVID caused. You have a lot of people that wound up breeding litters from dogs that maybe would have titled that didn't have the opportunity to. And my hope is that people start to really look at the dogs in front of them. You know, I try to tell people, like, titles are great. Health testing is super important. But at the end of the day, we're breeding dogs, not titles or health tests. You know, use both of those things to make informed decisions. You know, everybody has to draw their line in the sand of what they're comfortable with, and what they're not comfortable with. But at the end of the day, we're breeding living, breathing things. And sometimes we have to look at what's in front of us. Some of the best dogs that I've, or some of the best producers that I've had in my life have been dogs that have never titled. For one reason or another, whether that was access or attitude, or just they didn't fit the flavor of the day in one realm or another. You know, some of the best producers I've ever had have been dogs without titles. Mm-hmm. So really kind of looking at what's in front of you and not being influenced by, you know, okay, well, this dog did all this big winning, you know, kind of the popular sire thing.
Right.
You know, this dog did all this big winning, or, you know, this dog has produced 175 titles. So that must mean he's a really good producer. You don't see the other 600 puppies he's produced.
Right.
I mean, like, that's an exaggeration, but, you know, it just, sometimes I think we get lost in the popularity, or we get lost in the presence. Mm-hmm. And we lose out on some really good dogs and some really good genes. Mm-hmm.
But let me give you the flip side to that. So last week I saw a social media post, of a girl that is looking for a, you know, so-and-so breed of a puppy. Mm-hmm. And so she made a post of, I'm researching breeders, potential, you know, litters, and not interested in titles on the parents, just want good hunting dogs. So what's your opinion there? What would you reply?
I think there has to be an appreciation for some of the predictability that comes with having a background of at least some dogs with titles, or some dogs that are proven in some way. You know, Matt, when I met him, had a $50 Labrador out of the newspaper. And I will be honest with you, His name was Hunter, was probably one of the best dogs I've ever met. But the likelihood of that being replicated in a dog from no, you know, there's nothing proven behind him anywhere. The likelihood of being able to replicate that again is so minimal compared to going to somebody who, you know, is at least hunting their dogs, at least has some semblance of a subjective, of an objective performance evaluation somewhere. And I think it's hard for us that are so involved in the world of events and titles to sometimes take a step back and see how people who aren't kind of view that. You know, having the opportunity to hunt behind a Bisto and a Carmen was very eye-opening, I think, for him, where he sees the value in having a dog that is proven in some way, versus just Joe Schmo's two dogs out back that happen to go hunting every so often. I do think there are some people that will never see the value in that. They'll never understand that, in which case, you know, then it's doing our best to at least guide them to, here's the health testing you should care about. Because I think at the end of the day, we all want our dogs to be healthy and long-lived, I would hope. But I think we as responsible breeders, as responsible participants in dog events and responsible hunters need to help people see the value in the predictability and the longevity that comes with using proven dogs, and why, you know, hunting on heart may not be enough, because there's a whole lot of poorly structured dogs out there that just have the drive and want to do it.
While we're on the topic of value and maximizing your odds, it's worth mentioning Onyx Hunt. As I prepare to head into the unknown areas of Idaho solo hunting in a couple weeks, I'm already e-scouting options using Onyx, the number one hunting map. Some insider intel tells me crops are full of nice green cheat shoots right now, so my plan of attack is to focus on south-facing slopes with pockets that offer cheatgrass and shelter, and hope to get into a few late-season coveys. I've set a few waypoint pins in Onyx that look to have potential. This is the main reason why I've been using Onyx for years, because I can e-scout beforehand and maximize my time on the hills rather than driving around in my truck. Go to onyxmaps.com and find out more about all the features this app has to offer.
You're maximizing your probability of a dog that can, let's just say in this situation, hunt. If you have pedigree full of dogs that have proven that ability, any other way, you are selling puppies to people that say, yeah, I hunt. No, I don't have any interest in doing any testing with them. Well, that's great. And we all have the best dog, right? Like you say, so how did he turn out? Oh, he's great. He finds birds all the time. Every day I come home with a bag limit. You know what I mean?
Right.
But what is that? What's your definition versus my definition versus their definition?
Right. That's that objective, the objectivity piece of that, right? Of like, well, my criteria is different from your criteria, different from the next guy's criteria. So, you know, finding a system, whatever is appropriate, you know, NAVDA for your versatile hunting breeds. Maybe it's HRC, which is the UKC retriever tests for a retriever. You know, there's Upland tests for spaniels. There's all sorts of different things, and just finding your measure. You know, I had a conversation with somebody once about, you know, hunt titles and field tests, and well, everything should be a field trial champion. And I just said, like, I will never own a field trial champion toller in my lifetime, because that's way too much get up and go for what I need for a duck and a dove dog. And so, you know, finding that, to me, it goes back to this idea of find a breeder who their goals match yours.
Yeah. You and know? See them in person. Right. I mean, I can't go back to that enough, because at the same time, talking on the title dogs, you know, I've seen some show dogs with a champion title that should have never gained it. I've hunted behind versatile champions that you just go, how the hell did that dog do that?
Right.
And feel, you know, so it's all over.
Right.
And, totally. And you can just have a pet that you has never hunted in its life. And at 3 years old, you take it out and you're like, that's the best dog I've ever hunted over.
Totally. So like, again, going back, I mean, Matt's $50 newspaper lab, just honest to God, the best retriever I've ever met. And I've had retrievers now for many years. But again, what is the likelihood that he could go reproduce that by going and getting another $50 newspaper lab? And it's very minimal. So, you know, it's where is luck on your side?
And not to switch gears too much here, but when you say like the producing characteristics, that says so much too. And how, let's say, just we as breeders can look into future options, and then those I mean, there are a lot of prospective puppy owners that are educated. They're doing all the right things, mm-hmm. and they are going to those, to the NAVDA website, and they're looking up the stuff. And, you know, then you get the phone call of, so I've seen so-and-so dog has had five litters and they're all, they're average. I'm like, wow, you get a dog.
You have done your research.
Well, that's, good, you know, job.
The people who email me and say, like, I know that this isn't a small golden. I know that I'm probably getting into a dog that's smarter than me. I know that I'm getting into a breed or looking into a breed that needs a job. Like, kudos to you. You know, one of the upsides to the social media side of things is that that information is readily available. It's easy to find. You can talk to people that have the breed before, you know, you ever contact a breeder about wanting one. And those are the people where it's like, awesome. You've done your research. You know what you're getting into.
Mm-hmm. Right. So going back to the concerns of the social media influence, some of the negative things that can come out of that. And you kind of mentioned earlier the popular sire syndrome. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, I can say I'm totally guilty. I took one great picture of a dog years ago. And like, even I like uploaded on the computer. I'm like, wow, I've never seen him look that amazing before. Mm-hmm. And all the inquiries started coming, one photo. And yep. So it happens. And then, you know, breeders have to make decisions of, okay, how often do I want the dog used, and come see him in person.
I've gotten that even with, on the pug side of things, I upload a picture with like, you know, his health testing results or whatever. And unfortunately health testing's not as valued in a lot of toy breeds as it is in some of the sporting breeds, but people are like, oh my God, look at like, just look at how upright he is and look at how dignified he is. And like, okay, but let me tell you the reality of actually living with him, because he's not nearly as dignified in person as he looks in this picture.
Sure. And good for you. Kudos to you for doing that and saying the truth.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you have a lot of breeders that look for or manipulate that golden picture, and then they don't share the reality. And that's where we wind up getting into trouble. And suddenly you have dogs that are producing, or your point of filters, right? Like, people think they're breeding to this dog with spectacular pigment, and all of a sudden they're getting puppies that are completely lacking. Like, well, how does that happen? Well, because this photo or every photo has the same filter applied. So you don't know that this dog is lacking in pigment unless you were to see him in person.
Mm-hmm. Right. We had a situation, a client dog, you know, we always take photos and post photos of client dogs as long as the owners give us the approval for that. But somebody who had been specifically watching this dog as a potential one day actually called us and was like, I've only ever seen, like, there was one photo that this person had on their website that owned the dog, and it was the dog had a lower head. And so we get this inquiry of all the photos you have of this dog, his head is high. And what are you doing? Are you manipulating him? No,
we don't have time for that. No,
right. No, we don't do that. Do people do that? I think like, that was it. Like, do people do that? But, it's just that photo influence, like, it's crazy, the decisions and thoughts that people get over it. And I would never breed because the dog head's low. Well, that's one photo in the dog's entire lifetime where the head is low.
Ask for a video. I mean, like, there's so many ways around that, you know, and even to a degree, videos can be manipulated, or they can be cut short or whatever to hide things people don't want you to see. But it's so funny because some of the inquiries I've gotten, I can tell when people are horse people. Because videos are just super common in horses, or so is my understanding. So I can tell when people are horse people that have come into dogs, or they split their time between two worlds, because I'll get like, oh, I saw these pictures and I really like him. Can you send me videos? I would like a side gate video. I'd like a coming and going video. Can you show me some video of him just freestanding? And it's like, oh, okay. Yeah, for sure. I'd be happy to. But there's this value in like, I want to see the dog in motion, because you can't hide anything in motion. And I want to see it without the manipulation that's a possibility with the filters and with, you know, other manipulation, composites, that kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. Good point. And even you kind of mentioned earlier, like the, when people are looking to buy a puppy, like the here and now, like, do you, it's always the question of, do you have puppies right now? And if so, how much? Yep. And I know I've talked about this in other podcasts before, but I think we are, we have the general public, because I'm totally guilty with goats. I'll be like, you know, I can go to a goat farm and see 75 adorable little baby goats. And I'm like, I want the prettiest ones. I want that one. And that, and I wasn't supposed to get any, and I had three.
Yeah.
Yes. Like that one looks really naughty, and I love her, you know, but it's, so we're all guilty, and not so much with dogs, but I will say I am with goats. So I can't get too hard on people that do it with dogs.
I understand it.
I mean, an appearance allure.
Yeah, you've got, and you've got that instant gratification of like, that's really, you know, it's there, it's available. I can have it now, or in 2 weeks or whatever, but it, like, it's a tangible, like, ooh, that's really flashy. I really like those markings, or I really like that color, or, you know, I don't see it as much in sporting dogs as I do in some of the toy breeds, like the pugs. But the fad color market, right? Like, you know, breeding off standard colors, just because it's, you know, they're easy to sell. People look at them and go, oh, that's unique. I really want it. And the wire hairs and in the tollers, both the mismarks, where, you know, it's striking. It's beautiful. It's really cool looking. It's something that somebody else isn't likely to have. And depending on the color or the marking, it could appear totally natural from within a breed. But, you know, educating people that it's one thing if a breeder happens to produce it and have something available. It's another thing entirely if a breeder is actively trying to produce it. Right. Mm-hmm. And
good point.
A lot of these breeders that aren't looking to, you know, preserve a breed or breed to a standard have caught on to the fact that these puppies sell, and they sell quickly, and without people
asking, and probably for more money.
Mm-hmm. And you can sell them as rare, you can sell them as unique, and they're out the door like that. And so it's definitely a downside to kind of that social media age of, hey, look at this flashy thing, it's available now. Send me your money via another social media site, or Facebook. You can send them money right through the app now. You know, and it also opens the door for a lot of scam artists who don't even have puppies to say, oh yeah, I've got puppies available. Where are you? Send me money and I'll send you your puppy.
Yeah.
And have no puppies to produce.
Yeah. And I like how you touched on that point there where it's like, you know, mismarks happen. And I think most breeders are like, oh my gosh, I hope this dog never gets seen on social media. And, but it happened. And I mean, gosh, even think back of 10 years ago when in wire hairs, when they had mismarks, you hear everybody go, you just bucket that. I bucket those. I'm like, what does that mean? Well, you don't need to discuss it, but it just
a hard culling versus.
Yes. Yeah. Culling. Yes. Yeah. So, yeah. But like, and then you have the argument too of, they all have great genetics, right? Like you bred it because it has great genetics. And so it has a wrong color. So it has a oopsie mark, but it's not going to affect its hunting.
Right.
The health testing that's been done with its parents and the, hopefully the good temperament that the parents had. But I like how you said, if somebody is purposely breeding for mismarks or purposely breeding to, you know, fulfill the desires and the wants of people that are searching that, then you have to wonder where else that they might be compromising their breeding program to try to have priorities over the betterment of the breed.
Right. Are you then, do you start to select against maybe ideal temperament or against ideal structure? Because like, well, now there's a market for this. I know I can sell these puppies. Certainly nobody who is a responsible breeder is doing that. But there's an allure. I mean, people who are doing it right, you know, there's nothing wrong. I'm probably going to tick off some of your listeners, but there's nothing wrong, in my opinion, with a breeder who makes some money on a litter, as long as they're not cutting corners. However, when you start to cut those corners to make that money, like skipping health testing, or like, you know, starting to produce purposefully off standard dogs specifically to market them for more funds. That's where you start, in my opinion, to cross a line. And you start to wonder if you're willing to bend your ethics on that, where else are they willing to bend the ethics?
Mm-hmm. Right. The micro GWP comes to mind.
Oh, is that a thing? I hope that's not a thing.
Oh, it was a thing.
Oh no.
Yeah. The micro GWP.
Oh no.
There's a breeder for that.
Oh no. That's,
I hope I don't have people Googling it, because it's very annoying to me.
Oh, that's, I mean, I see it, like I said, I see it far more on the pug side of things than I do the tollers, but, you know, we have pink pugs now, which are albinos, and we have merle pugs, and we have, fluffy pug, all these things that the gene pool doesn't actually carry. So they've been introduced through some other breeding. You know, your teacup, anything that's just been bred down and bred down and bred down, and you know, the risk for liver shunts increases exponentially as the size gets smaller. You know, any of these fads that, again, like social media makes it so easy to share and so easy to market. And people, you know, unfortunately, things like, you know, the marketplace on AKC's website, or you know, there's all sorts of places that people can advertise where people think they're doing right by going through AKC. And unfortunately, you know, that side of things is just a listing. AKC is not, AKC is a registry. They're not, you know, they're not endorsing any of these people. You know, so people think that they're doing right by their process. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people, going back to like our creative advertiser point, there's a lot of people that have learned how to play the game that are not producing dogs with health and welfare and soundness and future families in mind, that have learned how to just capitalize on the marketing and the visibility of various social media.
And we already talked about, you know, mentioning ways that we can research dogs. I mean, I think obviously seeing them in person and hunting over them, you know, and I know when we have puppy inquiries and they've gone through all the questionnaire and stuff, we'll say, okay, now come over and meet them. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a lot of times we can go wrong with the social media aspect, is you see the cute puppy, it's available now, it's in the price range you want to spend, and then you buy it and you guys just aren't a good match.
Right.
You know, the dogs, it's a hunting dog and you only want a running partner.
Right.
Or...
Well, and did you have a breeder who took the time to say, like, okay, what are you looking for? And are they matching the puppy to, you know, the home and what their wishes are? You know, if it's a breeder who's saying, like, yeah, this cute puppy is available, or these four cute puppies are available, which do you want? Right. You're far more likely to have a home wind up with a puppy that's not appropriate for them, versus a breeder who's saying, okay, I might have these four puppies available, but tell me what you're looking for, so that I can match you to the puppy in the litter, right? So that the person who wants a couch potato isn't getting the dog that's going to eat their couch. And and the person who wants an active, you know, 4 months out of the year hunting partner isn't getting the dog that only wants to lay on the couch.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes. And I'm just thinking, because when we first got into the wire hairs, it was a couple, you know, a couple years later, and we thought it would be a really good idea when we bought our first house that we were going to put an in-ground fence in the backyard, because, you know, we didn't want a big structure. It was going to take away maybe the value of the house. And wow. So wire hairs don't mind an in-ground fence shock to clear out the neighborhood of the cats. Mm-mm. and the rabbits. So they cleared out the neighborhood cats very quickly. And, So that's something as a new wire hair owner myself at that time was really eye-opening. I'm like, I don't know if they're a great match for me. And then you take them out hiking and there's nothing you can do to break them up with fighting with a 50-pound raccoon. You just got to sit there and watch it.
Right.
So like, I'm not sure this is the dog for me. But it is, apparently.
And here you are.
Yeah.
How many generations later?
Right. But I did add broncos and a cocker who would never do outrageous things like that.
Right. Right. Never. Never. Never.
They are perfect angels. Angus is snoring right next to me. He's like, yeah. I would never eat a cat, Mom. I would just love it. It'd be with my pet.
I would just Google it.
I would just put all my rolls over its face.
It's, you know, eventually I really want a Bracco. It's the drool for me that I'm at that stage of my questioning, right? Like having spent time with yours and time with Quigley, it's like, I love the breed so much. I'm not sure I'm prepared for like the slime.
Yeah. It's amazing. Like I need, you know, like how when children grow, you put a pencil mark in the wall of like how it, I'm going to start doing it for the Bracco drool up that goes up the side of the walls. And like after every month, I'm going to see who has the highest one and they get a special bone.
And I just feel like you don't get an appreciation for that unless you spend time with the breed.
Yeah. Yeah. It's totally adorable and disgusting and impressive at all at the same time. They're pretty great.
I love them. They're excellent.
Yes. Okay. So what are other ways that people can research dogs going beyond what they're seeing on social media to know that like this is the real deal besides seeing them in person?
Yeah. Besides seeing them in person, I always recommend people go to the Breed Club website, right? So like Wirehairs would be GWPCA. Tollers have an obscenely long one because of course they do. Theirs is the Nova Scotia Duck Tolling Retriever Club of the United States of America, aka NSDTRC USA.
It's so stupid, annoying.
Everything with the breed is a mouthful. You know, Broncos have Bicca. I always recommend going to the parent club because they're going to be the best source of information, at least baseline information about, you know, what the breed should be like. Mm-hmm. I think one of the other really important places for people to look, especially if they've got a breeder they're interested in, is OFA. You know, what are the health testing results? They should be really easily verified publicly if your breeder is doing their due diligence as far as testing and making that information public. So I think it's really important for people to verify, you know, always believe, trust, but verify, right? Like, you know.
Yeah. So go into that a bit because some breeders will say my dog is health tested because it went to the vet last week and the vet said it's healthy. Okay. And also owner, you know, potential prospective puppy owners will also think the same thing of, right. Well, the vet said it was healthy, so it's good. And then even going to the OFA website isn't going to tell you the whole story because people, if you're taking your dog in to be health tested, you have an option to check a box on that form that says, if the test is abnormal, that would you like to have it published publicly or not?
Not correct.
So yeah. Go into that a little bit.
So one of the best ways around that for me is to look for breeders who are chick health testing their dogs, so CHIC. And it does not mean that a dog has to pass all of their testing, but it does mean that a dog has had all of the recommended testing completed and that the breeder has made those results publicly available regardless of the results. So to me, that would indicate that the breeder at least has a level of transparency, that they have nothing to hide, right? My results are there for the world to see. A chick number is not the end all be all, but it's certainly a great starting point. Downside to chick is that if a dog is like clear by parentage, right, you don't have certain testing completed. So certain genetic tests that are easily inherited, right, dominant recessive traits. You know, if a dog's parents are clear, you don't need to test the dog to know that they too are clear. So that's, you know, that can be a complicating factor. But then look up the dog's parents on OFA, right? So for me, it's looking up that information, what is readily available. OFA also has the vertical pedigrees, which are really neat. So that's where you can see siblings, right? And half siblings, you can see other relations. So great, your dog's parents have all excellence, but what do the siblings have, right? Are the siblings all dysplastic? Because you're likely to get a dysplastic puppy out of two excellent parents more so than, you know, a parent who maybe failed but is out of fully excellent bloodlines. It's not black and white. That's the mm-hmm. hardest part to this whole dog breeding, dog shopping game. But using that publicly available information to at least do your due diligence in verifying, is what the breeder telling you accurate? Is there anything that they seem to be hiding? Is there anything that's publicly available that maybe you want more information on? Like, hey, I noticed that, you know, the sibling to this dog was dysplastic. Can you tell me a little bit more about that, or how it's related, or how, you know, that's impacted elsewhere in the lines? Mm-hmm. It certainly varies from breed to breed. Your smaller gene pools, you know, breeders may have to make tough decisions that would be an easy decision in another breed. Tollers, for as much popularity as they're gaining, are very much still considered a rare breed genetically. So sometimes we have to make decisions that in another breed wouldn't be entirely kosher. Mm-hmm. So Munchie, my young dog at home, is a collie eye anomaly affected dog. I bred two carriers knowing that I was breeding two carriers, because it's not a disease that we see impacting the quality of life of our dogs significantly. So he was evaluated mm-hmm. at 8 weeks by an ophthalmologist. He was totally normal, not something that's ever going to affect him. But genetically, I did have to make that decision of, I love everything else about this breeding. Am I comfortable breeding two carriers knowing I could get an affected?
Right.
So in another breed with a wider gene pool, that wouldn't have been a question.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Absolutely. And you and I have had that discussion with wire hairs. I feel like the gene pool is very large. There's, mm-hmm. and some people might disagree with that, but I think when it comes down to making breed decisions, it's like, well, if it's not clicking all the boxes and the health testing, nope, not going to do it. But yeah. With Broncos, a more rare breed, you have to maybe make some compromises of that thought of don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. All in all, that's something that we can look at. And I do get inquiries a lot, you know, from people on this podcast that say, hey, I really want to start breeding dogs. Can you please do, you know, give some information on how you get into breeding, how do you start? And these, you know, they're people with good intentions that want to start breeding their dog. They know they have something special. So I think what you just mentioned there is a really important piece that will be helpful for them. And it's, yeah. And you mentioned going to the OFA website, looking them up, but all you need is the dog's registered name. That's what you type in.
Correct. Yep.
And, or even part of it, as long as you put in part of the name, if you know the dog, like the kennel name, and you, then you have the option of putting in the breed.
Yeah. So, and that's a great way to vet breeders. I mean, it's a great point that you bring up, because you can put in, and I can go type in Clada and put German wire-haired pointer and come up with a plethora of dogs from your breeding program, right? And see, you know, what they've had, what they've done, you know, what the results have been. And I can tell that you as a breeder are consistently testing and consistently making your results available. I might go type in another breeder's kennel name and not find the same consistency or the same transparency, right? So even not only researching to be a breeder, but to research breeders and see, like, not just the sire or dam, but the kennel as a whole. Again, going back to that trust but verify, being able to use that as a way to research kennels and see, you know, what kind of history do they have with OFA? Is this a kennel that is just recently starting to do health testing? You know, with the prevalence of genetic testing now with Embark and Wisdom panels and all of these other things, I think we see a lot of people doing genetic testing in lieu of doing orthopedic and eyes and cardiac and some of these other things that are equally, if not more so, important. You know, the reality with some of these genetic panels is that yes, your dog may can't come back clear on 145 things, but 140 of them aren't relevant to your breed. So they should come back clear on all of those, right? So again, going to the OFA website to verify like what is relevant to the breed and what are the results, not just are they doing some form of testing.
Another way I like to, and I found most beneficial, is to attend the national. They typically have them, you know, where it's show and field combined at the same event. A lot of them are trying to keep the events together and not split them. But in the larger breeds, you just can't help but split them because they turn out to be, you know, 3 or 4 week long events.
Right.
But if your interest is really want to see some big running dogs, go to the national field trial. If your main interest is I really need to bring some sound structure into my line, then go attend the national dog show.
Not for me.
And right. Yeah, absolutely.
Right. And I know a lot of retrieving breeds do similar, where they have the confirmation piece and they have a field portion, whether that's an AKC hunt test or a working certificate. I'm not as familiar with like the Spaniels or some of the setters, but you know, I know a lot of the retriever breeds do both as well, where it's, you know, various levels of fields relevant to the retriever. So tollers, for instance, the toller working certificate has a tolling portion. A toller cannot title with the national club in the field without demonstrating that they can toll.
Wow.
I believe they are awesome. The only breed club that has that requirement, which would make sense because it's one of only two breeds that have tolled historically. But yeah, you can go to a working certificate either at the national or in toller specifically. We have different regions that put on events throughout the year. And you can see the dogs work from we have what we call the BRT, the basic retrieving test, which is for baby puppies, basically a natural instinct test, all the way up through our WCX, our excellent, which has all sorts of marks and different technicalities that you would expect of like a finished gun dog.
And even some of the dog breed magazines are helpful. If anything else, good, you know, good articles and they're good reading material. If you want to get more involved in your breed specifically, look at joining those parent breed clubs. Not all social media is bad. You know, it's also used as a great resource. So
yeah.
What are some of the positive things about it?
You know, coming from a breed, I mentioned that tollers still have very much a rare breed gene pool, or as my mentor would call it, a gene puddle, much like the Bronco do. You know, we have a fabulous stud dog group. So we're able to go through and across the world, people post their dogs and their health testing and pictures and titles. And it's a great starting point when you're like, I really need a dog that has this, you know, these health testing results, and I'd like to see what he produces, and it's all kind of there in one spot where you can research. So that's definitely kind of an invaluable tool on the rare breed side of things. From a puppy buyer perspective, I think it's great how a lot of breeders have taken to doing like private groups to keep in touch with puppy buyers, to funnel out relevant information to puppy buyers. As a breeder, I love getting photos and updates and videos and just seeing what my puppies are up to. So that's a really cool way on the flip side of it for buyers to keep in touch and to continue to get that support and to just share, you know, we put our heart and souls into these puppies that, and then they go to their new homes and, it's nice to be able to kind of follow along and see their adventures.
Although there's breeders out there, they're like, once the puppy's out the door, I don't want to hear from you again.
I am not one of those people.
Yes. If you get a puppy from Kelly or I, notice that it's a bit of a marriage where there will be communication. If there's not, then that's really unfortunate.
And if you question how many updates are too many, the limit does not exist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. we love the photos and the photos of the dogs and the birds.
Yes, totally. And I touched on this a little bit earlier too, you know, the social media thing, it's a lot easier and quicker, I think, to keep updated. So I have a website. In fact, I updated it tonight for the first time in like 4 months. It's a lot easier to just pop something up really quick on social media from my phone versus having to log on and go and update HTML and do all of those things that come with maintaining a website. And it's free, right? So mm-hmm. we pay for our websites in a lot of instances. I know there's free options out there. But mm-hmm. social media is free and quick and easy.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. And I think I like seeing, and you know, maybe it's almost called that, like that stalker version of being on social media. But I, when I'm interested in dogs or breeders, I like seeing them just be dogs. Mm-hmm. I like seeing them playing with the kids. And, you know, you go to a website and like your best photos of every dog are on there and all their accomplishments. And, you know, I like to just see them being dogs.
So on that point, I actually had somebody once, on the pug side of things say to me, I love your dogs. I love your breeding program, but I wouldn't ever get a pug from you. And I was kind of taken aback. And I said, well, why is that? And she said, because you seem to only produce show dogs. And I just want a dog that's going to be a pet. And I just don't feel like you would sell me a dog because I'm not going to show it. Mm-hmm. And it made me take a step back and look at all of the things that we had posted to social media. All of the stuff on our website was really highlighting the accomplishments of our dogs in the rings because we were proud of them, right? Mm-hmm. And we were having some really great wins. But it made me take a step back to go, okay, if I am not a confirmation person and I'm interested in a puppy, what does this look like? And to that point, I've tried to really change the way that I interact on social media from the breeder perspective to show like our dogs are our pets first and foremost, and then they're hunting dogs and then they're show dogs and then they're all these other things, but they're a member of the family first. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important for us as breeders to keep that perspective too.
And even as a breeder who my husband is a trainer, I feel we exhibit something unrealistic as well. So we have access to pigeons here. We have access to birds. We have access to land. He trains all day long. That's mm-hmm. not the norm. So what we are doing here, and you know, when we're like taking videos and we're showing the dogs at 8 or 10 weeks old and they're pointing, or the master hunters at a year and a half, like, you know, our owners are like, oh God, I'm way behind. I'm mm-hmm. way behind. And they start to feel inadequate. And so you're right. Like we have to be aware of how we post that and portray it, but maybe even go into further explanation of why this is possible.
Mm-hmm.
Wanted to again, be realistic.
It's going back to that idea of like it being a highlight reel, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and people aren't seeing the hours, you know, as the sun comes up and all of the things after dark that William's doing, or that you guys as a family are doing to make all of that possible, or they right. don't see the, you know, hours to days on end of no sleep with our puppies when they're born and all of those things. It's not visible, generally speaking,
mm-hmm.
because yeah. we're portraying the idyllic, right? This is the best of what we have to offer.
Yeah, it's what they're seeing on social media. So they think that's what it is. And just listening to somebody with another breed, I heard on a podcast, I don't know, maybe like a year ago or so, you know, she was feeling inadequate because she saw someone with a litter mate to her dog that was doing all the things. And she's like, oh, my dog isn't even pointing yet. And so you're like, well, what's wrong with my dog? And you just start making those comparisons. And I think just try not to put so much into what you're seeing out there and just focus on what's best for you and your dog and take your own path and how you get to where you want to be and which way you go about it.
As corny as it sounds, it's the journey, not the destination.
Oh, it's not corny at all. Kelly's dropping the truth bombs. and even, you know, the positive sides of the social media, right? Like the networking being involved in seeing, you know, maybe some of the, our puppy owners aren't apt to text me that photo from their hunt, but they're really quick to put it up on social media.
Yep.
And so that's cool.
Your idea of like the, you know, here's what you guys can do because William's a full-time trainer, like the being able to connect to a training club or a NAVDA chapter or, in retrievers, like the HRC clubs, you know, being able to find those things or just connecting to various groups, you know, to say like, hey, here's an issue that I'm having. What resources, what techniques do you guys have? When prior to social media, that access wasn't there.
So, I wanted to ask you because, and we didn't really touch on this yet or talk, we haven't really talked about this yet. The fact that a lot of the dogs that you're hunting behind that you co-own, that you also show in confirmation. So you are doing all the things, which is a bigger combination than what most people do with their dog, with just one dog. And you've like won several nationals with all these dogs that you own.
I've been very blessed. I've only won one national, and that was with your beloved Bracken. But in the ribbons at a lot of nationals, which has honestly been an incredible ride, opposite with Merritt, with you guys, and what, like 10 days before he earned his senior, like, I mean, incredible to be at the top of both at the same time. Selected the Curly National this year with one of our Curlies.
You put a group placement on Carmen.
Yes.
Like who hates dog shows and like you.
Incredible, incomparable Carmen Fudge Brownie. I, you know, I said at the beginning of the recording, I'm very, very, very blessed to have the dogs in my life that I've had. And I was a strictly confirmation person for 20 plus years. I happened to attend a field trial at a Wirehair National because I was there working for a handler at the confirmation portion. And that was what was the very first spark in an interest in the field side of things, because there was nothing like seeing these dogs go out and run and point and spend a day on horseback watching them do what they were bred to do. I mean, like goosebumps just talking about it,
because it
was an incredible experience. And I was like late teens, early 20s when that happened. But not a lot of people get to do both sides of it like I do, which is just really cool. And I would say, much to Matt's happiness, I have really started to shift to enjoy my side in the field as much, if not more, than running around in circles in my pretty suits.
You're very pretty suits.
I have a problem. but I just, there's an appreciation that I couldn't have had until I started doing the field side of things. Pistol, my first toller that's been, you know, mine from start to finish, was an incredible starter dog. She's everything I needed that I didn't know I needed at the time. But she's taught me a lot about what it actually takes to be a functional bird dog. And she's great. So I'm not knocking her at all. But her son has a lot more drive, a lot more desire, a lot more naughtiness in trying to problem solve things on his own that I wouldn't have been prepared for until I was hunting. And now that I hunt, I have such a significant appreciation for and a desire for. And, you know, I think anybody who wants to do right by the field side of things needs to get out and do the field in whatever capacity that is for that person.
I love that. I hope you don't stop showing though, because like you are the go-to for anybody like me who just doesn't want to show dogs anymore. and knowing that like you can do some magic on the end of a show lead, like in anybody that sees you show will say the same exact thing, and they have, and they do. It's pretty amazing. And you just have such a beautiful knack and connection with every dog that's at the end of your lead. So
I don't think I could ever give it up entirely.
Thank God.
I maybe don't need to do it 45 weekends a year.
Yeah.
because that used to be my reality, and it does not leave a whole lot of time for hunting, especially with working a full-time job.
Yes. Oh my gosh, that's a lot. So I have to ask, a good friend of mine has wire hairs, mm-hmm. and she hunts. And I am going to be working a dog show in a few weeks. And I told her, like, you have two really nice wire hairs and you should enter them in the dog show. And like, I totally thought she was just going to start laughing and say, oh, hell no. And she's like, okay, sure. What do I need to do? Wear a skirt and a jacket? I'm like, yeah, don't wear a jacket, but maybe it's up to you. I go, you're going to definitely need some pantyhose and flats. So if you could help her out, like somebody who's never stepped in the show ring before, like she really does have two fantastic wire hairs that, you know, it's one of those things of like great hunting dogs, but they don't have the title. So is the title going to mean something? Yeah, to some people it does. They're very well structured, have fantastic coats, super temperaments. I'm trying to do a similar breeding to what those two dogs are out of because they're that great. But what is some advice that you can give to somebody that is just hunting dogs and has never stepped a foot in the ring before?
Number one is to prep the dog for it, right? So get them used to having their mouth looked at, having people peek in, having people touch all over them. You know, I said this to Quigley's owners with the Bracco before we went to the National together. You might be surprised how exhausting it is, even for a high octane hunting dog, because what we ask them to do at a dog show is so unnatural, because we ask them to just stand there, like stand there, pay attention, move nicely and collected and pay attention to me and ignore all of the things around you. You know, we breed these dogs that are like, interact with your environment. And then we take them to a dog show and we're like, don't interact with your environment. Right. But make sure they're used to people touching them all over.
Grabbing their balls.
Grabbing parts that people wouldn't normally grab.
Yep. We can say it on this podcast.
Checking for testicles, looking at teeth, you know, get them prepared for it and then take a deep breath and have fun. They don't ask to be there. They do it for us. You know, you laughed about leaving on the advice for somebody new to field trials, but my advice that I wrote down, applies to the dog shows too. Try to have fun. I always try to pick out, I take this approach in performance because I'm so not a performance person. Pick out one positive of the day. So something that you're really proud of, something that you did really well, something the dog did really well, something they handled really well, and then pick out one thing to work on for the next time, right? So like, oh my God, they did great at paying attention to me in this chaotic environment that they're not used to, but maybe we need to work on not jumping and grabbing my skirt as we go around the ring, right? Because that happens. But take a deep breath, have fun, pay attention to the judge, right? They're not going to lead you wrong. It's totally okay to say to a judge, this is my first time, right? Most of them are going to be really understanding, and we all want to see people continue, you know, a commonality. And I know we see this in terms of hunting too, is we're losing people more than we're gaining people. And so, you know, field confirmation, performance doesn't matter. It's all the same in terms of, you know, people need to encourage one another. And I think it's totally fine to say to somebody, say to a judge, say to another exhibitor, like, this is my first time. I have no idea what I'm doing. And for the most part, people will jump in and help and do what they can to make it a positive experience.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree. Yes. Okay. A couple fun questions for you. Because now that you're like this bird hunter and you enjoy these yummy meals, I've seen some pictures of your yummy meals. What is your favorite game bird recipe?
So I told you at the beginning, we do everything pan fried with butter the first time, just so that we can get a base flavor. Like, this is what we're working with.
Yeah.
And that's actually one of my favorite ways to eat duck now. But I actually made this last night. Probably my all time favorite is a sweet and sour chicken recipe that I adapted for pheasant. Mm. It's very labor intensive, but so well worth it. And then we serve it over a homemade fried rice. But it's basically cubing it, battering it in cornstarch and then egg, frying it, then throwing it into a baking dish. And it's a sauce of ketchup, white vinegar, distilled white vinegar, sugar, and a couple of spices. It's very, like, the ingredients are easy.
Yeah.
The battering and the frying is super labor intensive, which if you didn't have to do it, if you had like an air fryer or you had like a actual fryer, it would probably be a lot easier, but I don't. So
very cool. What is your favorite piece of upland hunting gear?
Besides my dogs and my gun, I have a pair of Stone Creek chaps. So Stone Creek hounds, their chaps are fabulous. When I fell in the mud bog in the first 15 minutes of my very first hunting trip, only thing that was dry was what was covered by those chaps. So was very impressed with those. That, and I have a Q5 vest. But I think any good quality vest that distributes the weight on your hips makes such a huge difference. I resisted for years because I was like, oh, I don't want to spend that kind of money.
Yeah.
And my first hunt with it, I was like, why did I ever fight buying one of these?
It makes a big difference, right?
It's huge.
Does it weigh on your shoulders?
Yeah. I'm a migraine sufferer. So like having the pressure on my shoulders was triggering headaches and migraines after hunts.
Oh no.
None of those issues since buying a good vest.
So. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. What are you shooting?
My go-to for upland is my Benelli Montefeltro Compact. I'm a shorty, so even unfortunately, most of the women's guns are too long for me. I have a 12 inch length of pull, so I'm itty bitty.
You're very impressive.
But the compact seems to fit well. So that's been my
awesome. Is that a 20 or a 12?
20.
Okay.
And then I actually bought for this year for waterfowl specifically so I could stop beating up too badly on the Montefeltro. I bought a Franke Affinity 3 compact. That was my happy master's degree present to myself.
That's awesome. Do you like that one?
I do. I love it. I've only shot it a couple times. Matt actually stole it for pheasant hunting in South Dakota last month and liked it other than it being significantly too short for him. But I've been really happy with both of them so far.
That's awesome. It was really cool at our Bracco National this past year. We not only had like the show outside because sporting dogs should be outside in grass.
Gigantic ring.
Massive, massive ring, especially the Bracco, to see that big old flying trot that gives everybody goosebumps because they are awesome. Mm-hmm. And we had the hunt test, but something cool for everybody is at Wings North in Minnesota is where the national was held. And we got to do sporting clays.
That's awesome.
So that was awesome. And Kelly is a great shot. So like, if you like want to go and shoot and be super humbled, go shoot with Kelly because she is awesome.
Well, I had a good teacher, but thank you.
It was very fun.
Some of those stations were a little intimidating though. There were a couple of those that were like, I could stand here all day and not hit one of these.
That was the first place where I've seen like, the little ones?
Yes. Yeah.
Have you seen those before that?
I have not. Now, granted, I've not shot at a ton of places, but that was the first that I'd seen. What did they call them? The minis?
Minis? Yeah. I'm like, did anybody just hit that button or no? Because I think I saw something, but are you supposed to, is that it?
Okay, bye.
And there it went.
That was it.
All right. We'll just put another zero in that box.
But I vote all sporting dog nationals should have a round of sporting clays at some point because absolutely. That was just a riot.
It was so fun.
Loved it.
It was so fun. All right. Well, Kelly, if you could tell listeners how we are able to connect with you and hey, if we have some really great hunting dogs that we think I just want somebody that can appreciate this dog and give me an honest opinion and hey, maybe even handle it in the show ring for me and want to find out more because you are the go-to person for that. You will give an honest opinion. You know bird dogs, you know, sporting dogs. So
there's no sense in taking there's no sense in the frustration of taking the dog that's not going to be successful into a dog show.
Right.
It's not worth it for the people or the dog. But email is probably the best. So okay. It's foxpointgundogs@gmail.com. I'm also on Facebook as Fox Point Gundogs. So Gundogs is one word on there. So easy to find on Facebook. And then for those dogs that do want to do the dog show thing and have something a little fancy, a little extra, I do make the braided kangaroo leather show leads. And that is also on Facebook as Ringleader, all one word, Roo, R-O-O, out of, like I said, kangaroo leather. So
perfect. Awesome. Yeah. They're beautiful leads. And this is going to be a wake up call. Like, yeah, you can't bring your leash and collar to a dog show and use that and run it around the ring as much as those of us would like to. Like, there's a real thing that's called a show lead.
Yeah.
And it's show collar and there's all
don't
the
bring
things.
On the big flat buckle collar, please. Or with, like, the big chains. Like, you would tow a car with. Like, don't do that.
Don't do that.
Mm-hmm. Get yourself proper equipment. It doesn't have to be a fancy kangaroo lead, but if you've got questions, let me know. I can at least point you in the right direction, even if it's not one of my leads.
But it may as well be, because if you're going to go in or go home, like, do it big.
Right. That's right. My other obsession besides my fancy suits.
I love it. Awesome. Thank you so much, Kelly. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And have a great time on your goose hunt tomorrow. I can't wait to hear about it and hopefully see some pictures.
Awesome. Thank you.
Kelly brought some great insight on this topic regarding social media influence on making dog decisions. As she explains, much of the time we only see the highlight reels. So suggest that we do our due diligence and research the dog or breeder before making decisions based on photos. Thanks everyone for listening. If you enjoy these podcasts, I'd really appreciate it if you could leave a rating and review on whichever platform you're listening on. For your bird, dog, and hunting needs, please check out Purina Pro Plan, Boss Shot Shells, Onyx Hunt, Siren USA, and Dakota 283. And don't forget, support the conservation organizations of the birds you're chasing after and the public lands in which you hunt. Happy New Year, everyone.